Yeah, when I was young, me and my brother used to share a bedroom together, and we had a double bunk. And he would have the top bunk because he was the oldest, and I had the bottom bunk. And at night time, as soon as the lights go out, and I can't remember what age we were, I'm just assuming I was really young, he used to tell me these stories of murder and like mayhem, right?
Yeah.
And I, you know, Lizzie Borden. Do you know Lizzie Borden?
Yeah.
Lizzie Borden took an axe and gave her mother 40 whacks. Is that how it goes?
Yeah.
I only know that story because of my brother telling me as a 10 or 8 year old laying on the bottom bunk.
Yeah.
And then I remember he would say things like, you know, I could kill you right now and no one would.
With very straight, it's like deadpan.
Yeah, there wasn't any aggression or anything. It was just like, I think he was just pondering the concept of that.
Just working out if he could do it. Yeah.
Lovely dude. Great guy. Great brother. I just got a quick disclaimer. Great brother. Great role model. But
yeah, one of the great dudes.
Just scared the living shit out of me when it was bedtime. Yeah. I quickly got my own bedroom and we parted ways. But
yeah, there you go. Live it. Which brings us to our guest today, which is who is one of Australia's greatest, you know, actors, I think. And he delivers those lines with that same kind of gravitas, that integrity, that kind of truth.
My brother delivered. Brilliant.
Exactly. That Anthony Hopkins does Hannibal Lecter. Damon's great gift through winning actor awards, you know, through, you know, Logie.
He's won film awards with you, right?
Logie Awards, absolutely. He's working with Tarantino. He's working with Clint Eastwood. He's working with David Fincher. He's working around the world, and he's essentially, you know, I've even offered him parts, and maybe we'll go into it today, where he said, oh, I don't want to play the bad guy anymore, because he's so good at playing that kind of truthful bad guy. You kind of really, you know, he doesn't want to stay there because he can play anything.
Yeah. I got a bit nervous about this because I watched Mindhunter and I loved it, and I've seen him in
he's a great Charlie Manson.
Yeah, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And so because I'm not from that background, I'm not my world is business people, and you walk in and everyone's a dork, right? So to talk to people from Hollywood who are living in LA who are making movies, I'm excited about this.
Yeah.
And when I was researching Damon to sort of go, what's the common thread that I can find, and I'll bring this up with him, and is you know, for me, it was creativity. And I think when I watched his work and I went away and watched a few of his movies that I hadn't seen, he's an artist, right? He's an absolute artist. And I think
he brings everything to every role. That there's an integrity. Even the bad guys, you sort of kind of have a humanity about him. He's visibly short.
What is it with Adelaide? What is it with Adelaide?
Adelaide, man.
Your wife?
My wife, Ben Baker. Justin Kurzel, Ben Baker. There's lots of wonderful artists.
Jason Gillespie.
Dizzy.
Yeah. Adelaide.
Greg
Blewett.
Okay, let's talk to Damon.
Mark Taylor's probably going to like.
I reckon he would be.
Here he is. Dear Luke and Ben. Where are you, Damon? Are you in LA at the moment?
I'm in LA. Yes, I'm in my... Have you been to my place here, Luke?
I have, man, yeah. Have you in the same one?
Yeah, so same place I've been... For a while, living room,
nice. Dining. Yeah, it's a lovely little spot.
Yeah, so I just got back here a week ago. I've been in Thailand for 4 months doing a Netflix miniseries.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's about is that with Joel Edgerton?
No, but it's the same story. He did the Ron Howard movie version.
Right, it's a Ron, yeah.
And then I did the Netflix, different roles and everything, but I did the Netflix
Nice.
How many children do you have now? Like 9 or
me?
Yeah,
I have 3. Yeah, no, I had another one. I had another one 6 months ago. Yeah, we had a dog in the first COVID lockdown, and then we had a human in the second lockdown. Yeah.
Wow. So what's your separation between first and last child?
11 years.
Wow, most married couples aren't still having sex at that point.
Well, this is true. And look, I mean, COVID, lockdown hit us hard, D, and we had to do, you know, we had to sort of make do, you know, like and live on bread and cheese and water and stuff and just, you know, roll about the house. So, yeah, no, it's good, man. It's good. It's so good to see you because it's like.
We on. Not
really. We're just jamming.
We just jam, man. Yeah. We catch everyone out like that. So we just start talking. Even Rosso was sort of like, well, are we on? This is just talk. Yeah, no. So we don't. It's not like an informal. It's not like a formal Q&A.
Okay. I just want to be. Well, there's a difference between what I might say to you, Luke.
Yes.
Not on air and on air is all.
100%.
I was telling. Where we met, and I think it was the news. I mean, I knew you beforehand. We sort of went to, you know, we mixed in the same actor circles in Sydney. But but really, when we made the news, which is 2010, going back 11 years, or 2009, maybe we finished it. And you get, I say this to Nash Edgerton all the time, and you get embarrassed, but you are probably, universally in this country revered as probably one of our greatest actors.
I'm very embarrassed to hear that.
Versatility. I mean, your awards show it. Supporting actor, leading actor. You've played women. You've played men. You've played serial killers. You play everything. And it is, you've got an incredible body of work now, which I don't think it's out of line to say that you're one of the top actors in the country. There you go. Boom. Reply.
I can send you several videos of work to completely disprove that theory, Luke. But thank you. That's very, very, very nice of you to say.
Can I get to something way more important than this?
Yeah,
really
sure,
quickly,
please.
Wikipedia says you're 56.
Yes.
There's no way.
51.
56.
51. 51.
You don't look well. 51. Okay, 51. Wikipedia says you're 51.
Yeah. Everyone says this. Yeah.
Dude, you look young.
Dude, you are not 51. That is ridiculous.
No. I am. I just have very young looking parents. I've always.
Yeah, but you don't actually have wrinkles, Harriman. Like you don't like.
No, I do. My parents just both have really good genes. They neither of them look their age.
Yeah, but it is true. You've still getting cast as you would still get cast as like 30, like 20 years younger. Yeah.
No, not anymore. No, you're catching me on a good day. I can look. You should see me in the morning, mate. I actually have just played a couple of roles where I was playing my own age, you know. And I wasn't looking in the mirror going, "Oh, they need to age me up." I looked as old as I was playing, and I probably, you know, sometimes play around 40, but not 20 years younger.
Yeah, it's the Michael J. Fox thing, man. It's a wonderful thing to have.
Yeah, it is.
You know,
it's certainly not a bad thing. Thanks, Mum and Dad.
Mate, where are you right now?
I'm in Los Angeles. I've had a place over here for about 10 years, and I guess I've been coming over here for about 16, 17 now. It's nice to be back.
Do you feel like home? Do you think LA's home, or is Australia home?
It sometimes does, but generally Australia does for me. I sort of have three different homes in a way. Adelaide is the home I grew up in until I was 18. Sydney's, you know, the home that I've had for most of my life, and then LA's kind of a third one. It never feels quite like home in that way that you know, the word home sort of has a certain meaning to people that involves an emotional connection, I think, and it doesn't quite have that. But I do like it here. I didn't used to like it here. I didn't like it one little bit at the start. I found it like the whole place felt like a party you didn't have an invite to, and you were standing out in the rain tapping on the window. It was not a very friendly place to rock up to.
No.
When you're starting an acting career.
But even on the back of like when we tour with Rabbit, and when I've ever been, even on the back of sort of like being invited places, it still kind of felt like that at times, eh? Like it's such a hard place to go into with like without a swagger, unless you're sort of walking in, you know, high-fiving the doorman.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the combination of not knowing anybody or knowing the place, not having the familiarity of places or where things are, how things work, and also just feeling like that. It's really like that new kid at school feeling. It takes you back to when you changed schools as a kid and you're suddenly walking into a terrifying classroom of strangers. And LA sort of feels like that when you first come here, because you just don't feel particularly welcome. At least that was my experience. I think There are people who've had wonderful experiences coming here because they've been snapped up straight away, or they've come on the back of some big Australian film that everybody was talking about. I just sort of kind of shuffled in with not much going for me, and I was 34 at the time, which is kind of older than you would normally be to first make a trip over here. So it felt like, it didn't feel like they were welcoming me with open arms at all.
To be getting the role, you need to be in LA, or does it not make a difference?
They always tell you that. I haven't found that's the case. And I think COVID has finally convinced them that it's not the case, because everyone here is now doing meetings over Zoom, auditions over Zoom.
You can work from home now. It's changed everything, yeah.
It's changed everything. Agents and managers are all working from home. So I think yes, to answer your question, definitely they would say, you need to be here, you need to be here. But I found that was just Look, sometimes you do, but generally that was just a feeling of them not wanting you to, you know, to not be in LA, you may as well be on the moon as far as they're concerned. This is the center of everything. And to say you're in Australia just feels like so far away. Yeah. But, you know, I've been here in that period where, you know, that crossover period where the internet just got a lot faster and easier to upload and download. So when I first came here,
dial up to broadband.
When I first, 100%. When I first came here and there were self tapes in Australia while I was here, or self tapes for here while I was in Australia, I was recording them onto mini DV tapes and FedExing them.
Wow.
You know, and then. So at that point, yeah, it did feel like it would have been better to be here. But one, now with just like putting tapes down and uploading them instantly, there's not really any real reason that you have to be here unless someone wants to meet you in person. But again, since COVID, nobody wants to meet anybody in person.
Well, I remember, like, even in what I do, writing and directing, I'm finding that when I do my stints in LA, I had actually more meetings cancelled, you know, like we're meeting at Soho House and stuff, and like more stuff would cancel than when I'm here. I'm actually having more meetings over Zoom now, and they're actually happening because people don't have to get dressed up. People can sort of double meet. They can sort of like have their kids in the background. Actually, it's more productive, you know, like in this day and age.
I feel busier because of Zoom. The reason I asked that question about does it help being in LA, for me, prior to COVID, I was in Surry Hills, and I've been in Surry Hills for 20 years, and I could go to a conference, or I could go to a have a coffee, or go to a lunch with someone, and I would get work out of that. It would just happen, just by the presence. And when COVID happened for the first year, we weren't physically present. I just wasn't getting work. It just disappeared because I wasn't having the conversation and asking for that, you know. So that's why I asked. I just think that, you know, is audition still traditional, like in the old sense? You still got to walk into a room and audition, or do people ring you now knowing your work and go, here you go, this is, we want you?
That stuff has changed a bit over the years, but it still really depends. There are some things where a job just comes in as an offer, which is so nice. I mean, having spent decades doing auditions, I hate auditioning. Most actors do. It's not fun. It's scary. You know, you're putting it. If you really want the role, it's devastating when you don't get it. Especially if you did a bad audition and you know you could have done a good one. So when you don't have to audition for a role, it's a very, very nice feeling. But I certainly still have to audition a lot of the time, and certainly in America, I nearly always have to audition still. So that's. You know, it's pretty much all self-tapes now.
Was it the roles that you went there for? Well, was it this sort of like this idea of getting off the plane in LA and, you know, picking up was it the roles that you didn't see in Australia, or just wanting to sort of spread your wings and see what happened?
The first thing that sort of spurred on the idea of coming here was I went for the green card lottery, which, for people who don't know, is the US offers 50,000 green cards around the world to certain countries every year. And it's done in a lottery system initially, and then you sort of have to pass a few different tests. Anyway, I entered it once, I got it, and then I suddenly went, okay, well, I guess I need to go to America now because I can't not go because I've won this thing. I hadn't really thought it through too much when I entered it. But my agent at the time had opened up a management office in LA. So I knew that if I went to LA, I'd have a manager. So that would be something. Yeah. Anyway, long story short, I did go. I intended to go for a year at least. I had the worst time of my life. I got deeply depressed. I didn't know anyone. I didn't get one audition. I came home 10 weeks later with my tail between my legs, you know, swearing I'd never come back. And I probably might not have. The only reason I did again was because I did this American film called House of Wax in Australia in 2004, I think. And
Paris Hilton with Paris.
Paris Hilton.
Yes.
And the American actors on that were so lovely, and they were saying, you know, you've got to come to America when the premiere happens. And I thought, you know what, I had such a horrible time last time. I should go over for a month and have a fun month, and be there for something rather than just be there going high and you know, having just zero success at all. And so I did that. And because I was in the film, even though it was only a small role, I was able to get a manager and an agent out of it. And that's then why I kept kind of coming back.
I was trying to connect what you do and what I do and what Luke does. You guys are obviously inherently connected in terms of your work, but I was sort of trying to see where I fit in, and there was this sort of thing that sat in the middle of this, which was this word of creativity, right? The ability to create or solve a problem. And we were talking before this around Ken Robinson. I'm going to come back to your 1 year in Hollywood as a tough year, but so you right. move into the arts, you move into to acting, which I feel like is a challenging choice anyway.
It's very safe and secure. Yeah.
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 How do you choose that path when you know that it's tough? But secondly, you then move to LA and you just said you had the toughest year of your life.
You keep going back.
What is it within you that says that I'm going to push through this and I can find that opportunity?
Look, I think for me, it's partly that I don't know what else I would do if I weren't doing this. It's not, you know, I'm not one of those actors who, you know, will wax lyrical about their desire to change the world and that, you know, that being an actor is the most important thing ever. Like, I love my job mainly because it's a really fun way to make a living and you meet really cool people. And so I want to keep doing it. In terms of why would I keep coming back after it being so horrible, and even when I did come back after that first trip, which was truly awful, even the next few years weren't great. Like, I wasn't getting many, or if any, I'd do trips where I didn't even get any auditions, and I certainly did trips where I didn't get any work. I call it regret insurance. It was really less about going, damn it, I'll show you. I know you're gonna see how good I am and cast me in something in the end, and I'm gonna take over the world. It was none of that at all. It was actually just, I need to have tried enough times so that when I'm 85 in a rocking chair, I don't regret not having done it.
That's wonderful. Mm. That's so good.
It's a sort of a weird, like, half glass full version of wanting success. It's kind of like, I need to, it's almost like I'm pretty sure I'm not going to succeed at this, but I need to be sure that I've proven to myself that I tried and proved that I was right, that I wouldn't be successful. Mm. And I nearly did prove that.
That is so good.
There's something about that, though, because I don't think that's actually the opposite of glass half. You've got this belief there that says, well, sooner or later, I'm going to make it.
I didn't really, though. It was that I just needed to try enough times and fail to know that I wouldn't regret it later. There were enough, like, for example, after House of Wax, I came here.
I enjoy the LA soundscape. That works.
It's the LA soundscape. When I came here after House of Wax, I did a trip for 3 months, didn't get any work. A few months later, I came back for another trip for 3 months, didn't get any work. Now, someone who had more belief in themselves would have, and I know people like this, would have said, I'm just going to keep coming back and I'm going to keep doing it until I get work. I said, okay, I get the hint. I'm not going to get work here. I'm going to do one more trip. If that trip leads to no work, I'm never coming back again. And I got one job on that trip. And so that then made me go, oh, shit, well, now I have to go back again.
Yeah. Do you get the deadline? When you put a deadline like that in place and go, you know what, I'm going to give it one more chance and you know this is the end, do you feel like there's a more urgency or you dig a bit deeper?
Maybe. Yeah, that's a really good question. Maybe because I truly would not have come back again after that trip if I hadn't got a job. And again, it wasn't like, oh, I'm taking the bat and ball and going home in a huff. It was just like, I'm very much a realist and I probably see things, sometimes in too much in that way. Whereas where I was basically looking, I would have looked at that three trips and gone, no, I proved that I can't get work in America, and that's fine. Not everyone can. And at least I know now. And so when I got that first job and then a couple more, it was kind of odd to me and unexpected. But it also completely changed my outlook because I had gone from, I cannot get a job here and I'm fine with that, to, oh, okay, I can get a job here.
Yeah.
Well, maybe if I can get a job here, I can get another one, and then maybe I can get a better one.
Well, the hook was still dangling too, wasn't it? I mean, Ben always talks about, and he's done a talk on this idea of failing, and not even failing, but sort of like getting to a point to learn from that. And I think as an artist, it works for me. I don't know if it, you know, by what you're saying, it sort of refers to your process. As long as you're getting in the mix and there's enough there, I think, you know, and there's plenty of people, wonderful actors and directors and stuff, that have one or two knockbacks and say, this is not for me, and they go and get a steady job and they're making lots of money now. But I had to stay in it just through that period and learn from those kind of near misses and understand that it wasn't a personal thing. And once creatively, I think you get through that and think it's not because of, I mean, it could be kind of different for you because your acting is a visual medium as well as a director. You're just saying, well, I don't like your idea, so, you know, go away, you know. So, but it's still staying in the game. And
it's experience, though. I don't think you can undervalue the, you know, that first year and you go home and you come back and say, I'm going to go again. And you come back knowing more than you knew last time, you know. So if you're there in that first year and you said it's like going to school for the first time, you're not your ultimate self if you're feeling vulnerable around the people in the place and you're not trusting the environment. Yep. Whereas you come back and go, I've got more trust.
You know a bit more.
That's gone. Now yeah. Being you, right? So it's different.
Yeah, and this weird thing happens where you start slowly going from being the person who's asking all the questions to being the person that other actors are asking you the questions. Yep. It's like, oh, right, yeah, I guess I know a bit how it works there now. And I can give advice to someone about
where Whole Foods is and Farmer Joe's and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I had a business that failed probably around the same time you started going to LA. It was about 16, 17 years ago, and it was a disastrous fail. And I was very, very unaware of the potential problems of making shit decisions, you know, and how a thousand little shit decisions can add up to one big bad one, you know. And then this business, which was, you know, employing 30 people, just went belly up through a series of shit decisions. And, you know, the interesting thing about that is it felt like my life was over. You know, that part of my life is probably the most important part of my life. And I rarely give advice to people on business, but if I did to someone I cared about, it'd be from those lessons that I got then, you know, because you just can't pay for that, you know. So
no, it's true. No, it's true. It is amazing how much stuff just seeps into you and you realize, oh, I guess I kind of know how that thing is now. I know how this place works now. I didn't have to study it. It's just sort of there from coming back over and over again.
But it's almost the instinct that was in you, obviously, from a young age. You wanted to act, you know, you got in front of a camera, but it's like you as an actor too, and again, I'm going on my experience of working with you, but everybody that you are such an instinctive, your choices are so instinctive. You know, there are actors that are very measured and very sort of, you know, like, you know, you can almost see the wheels, you know, going around in their head and the choices they make. Whereas you are, what you give a director and what you've given me and what you give other people that I talk to about you, your work, is that you are, it's just such a real truth. You know what I mean? Is that always, do you think that is, if someone was to sum up your work, would you say that's a fairly apt description of every role you inhabit is very truthful?
Oh, well, thank you, firstly. That's very sweet of you to say. I definitely am trying to do that. I don't always succeed, I promise you. And look, I tell you, you know, all credit to good writing. I go on about this all the time now whenever I can. I guess I didn't when I was much younger because I didn't get exposed to as much of
good stuff.
Good stuff. But my God, when the dialogue is good, it makes acting so much easier. And conversely, when it's not so great, it makes it really hard. It makes it hard to look like you're a good actor when the dialogue is rubbish. Because if people don't talk a certain way and you have to say these words that they've written for you, it's really hard. So, yeah, I'm definitely always trying to do that, to make a character feel real. Even if it's a big character, you know, because sometimes people confuse that, the concept of being truthful or real with being small. And I love doing that too. But then there are terrific, you know, roles that come along that are larger than life characters, but still trying to embed them with a truth and
that's what you do. And I mean, I think Ben's going to get into the bad people you've played, but I mean, Dewey Cox and Justified and what the humanity that you've managed to bring to
Dewey Crow.
But the humanity that you managed to bring to these, you know, kind of, let's face it.
Can you bring humanity to Charles Manson? Can you do that?
Yeah. You're chosen for this not to play cardboard cutout one-dimensional villains either.
I'm sure there are actual moustache twirling villains who go, "Oh, I love being evil." But most people who do, you know, bad things justify it to themselves somehow. And right. Yeah. If you can kind of bring that out in the performance, then it's going to be better, I think.
So when you're playing Charles Manson twice, do you have to go and research that character? And if you do, like, what do you learn about a guy like that that you're uncomfortable playing? Or like, I'm just fascinated by that.
Yeah, I definitely did more research on that character than anything I've ever done before. And that was a couple of reasons. One, because I had a huge lead up time. Mindhunter, I had about 6 months notice when I got the role. And that was because they had to make the prosthetic makeup, which was extraordinary. You know, just an absolutely amazing makeup job. So because of that, I had this 6 months where I just did a really deep dive into, you know, reading books about him, documentaries, podcasts, and spending a lot of time watching him. There's a lot of video of him being interviewed over the years. So, and then sort of narrowing it down and doing these videos that were him, you know, crazy Charlie, funny Charlie, serious Charlie, quiet Charlie, just to try and see, can I get a bit of all those elements of him? Because, you know, even in all that time, just to finish my other thought, the other reason I you know, wanted to spend so much time getting it right is because it was on a really respected show. At that point, I didn't know about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but Mindhunter, I knew I was going to be on Mindhunter. It was a respected show. And I was playing someone that people knew. So I didn't want to get it wrong. I wanted to get it as, do it as good a job as I could. And I knew that there's no way of winging. You can't just wing playing Charles Manson. He's too specific guy, you know, and even with all the months of research I did, I still didn't really get to the bottom of what made him tick. Mm-hmm. I think there was so much going on in terms of various, you know, mental disorders and probably schizophrenia and behavioral disorders. And again, depending on the day and who was talking to him, he presented different versions of himself. So at the end of the day, I couldn't tell you too much about what made him tick because I don't really know. I'm not sure anyone will ever really know. You know, you got to get ideas. But so really, at the end of the day, all I was trying to do in that Mindhunter scene is just, you know, take that scene as it was written and present as close a version of the Charles Manson that I had come to know as I could.
And was that – so the Tarantino thing, I know you probably said this a few times, but it did – so that just came – coincidentally, or that came through sort of like just to play the same role? Was that through management or something that you then got cast as Charlie again?
It was sort of coincidental in that Quentin Tarantino didn't know I was already playing it. The way that came about is Nicholas Hammond, who people who don't know
yes,
who that
I
is,
know Nick, yeah,
Friedrich from The Sound of Music, Friedrich. But he's also plays the director of the TV show that's being made in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. So he was already working on that film. And also Timothy Oliphant from Justified was working on it.
Yes.
And together they kind of had concocted this idea about Quentin seeing me for Manson because they knew that he hadn't cast Manson and they both knew me. And so they pitched it to him and he knew who they were talking about because he's a big Justified fan. So he knew who Dewey Crow was when they said Dewey Crow. So that's how that audition came about. But at the time I auditioned, he didn't know that I was already doing the other one. And, you know, when I got the news that I'd got Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I was thrilled and sort of devastated at the same time because I assumed that once he found out I was doing the other one, that he would say, "Oh, well, I'll get someone else. I'm not going to have the same person." And thankfully, luckily for me, he didn't.
Didn't bother him. Yeah,
apparently not. No.
How does it feel being a role like that? Is that a dream role, or is that just part of the progression? Do you feel like, wow?
Oh, definitely. I mean, both of those were dream roles for similar but different reasons. I mean, in both cases, you know, David Fincher didn't direct Mindhunter, but he was there a lot. Andrew Dominik directed it, who's a brilliant director. And then, of course, getting to work with Quentin Tarantino is a dream for most actors. So there was all that. And then a dream role, especially, I guess, in the Mindhunter scene because there was just so much meat to it. There was actually more too in the in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is on the deleted scenes on the DVD.
Actually, because that comes up a lot of articles, doesn't it? That deleted scene.
There are actually two deleted scenes. There's the one where he does that crazy dance for Brad Pitt, but there's actually a two-page conversation that he has out the back of the house after he goes up to the house at the in the scene you see in the film. And that's a brilliantly written scene. Like, it's just great Quentin Tarantino dialogue. You know, what I was saying before about getting to act good dialogue, that was just like, it just came out like, you know, like honey.
it so did. Do you think, in a way, maybe I'm just trying to think of the reasons as a director of not making it about Manson, possibly of how that hit the cutting room floor, you know?
I think so. I mean, I think there are a couple of reasons. One is there are 100 minutes of that film that made the cutting room floor. So there's a whole other film that you could make out of that film. And he's talked about maybe doing a mini-series version with all that stuff put back in, which would be really cool. So that's one reason. It's just the film couldn't have been long as it is. I think the other reason is the two scenes that we shot that were cut did kind of humanize Charlie and in a way that he's not in the final version. In the version that exists now, there's this sort of mystique around Charles Manson. I just think with those scenes in, there's probably just less mystique. You get to see him almost being kind of
human.
The scene that, you know, at the guest house, he's kind of, it's kind of a light, funny scene. Mm. And I think that does take away the danger a bit, and I think that's probably partly why he took it out as well.
Yeah, it's clever. It left a lot of mystery for someone like me who knew really little about him. I was like, there's a lot of questions to be asked, you know, after.
He seemed like a very nice guy.
You don't stop thinking about it, you know. Did he ever kill anyone? I know that in the film I saw, you know.
No. Well, I think he did, but it's not in the film.
He didn't directly kill anyone at the Sharon Tate house or at the La Bianca house the next night. He was at the La Bianca house. He wasn't at Sharon Tate's house, but he did. He has shot other people and is presumed to have killed other people.
Yeah, fascinating.
He was a bad guy. Yeah,
he wasn't a good guy.
Safe to say.
All right, so I'm going to dig a bit deeper and just go. It's interesting. I always have this sort of utopian view, you know, if I watch a movie with the kids, you know, a Hollywood film, and I always feel like that, you know, you're at home in your lounge room, but I feel like your whole life is just hanging out, having coffees with Brad Pitt and Quentin Tarantino. How close do you become with these people? Like, what's Hollywood like behind Hollywood, behind what we see, what I see every day?
Oh, look, I mean, I think there's a version that I'm not particularly privy to, which is probably more of that. I'm certainly not having coffee with those guys. I tend to have coffee with Aussie mates that are over here. There's a large contingent of Australian actors over here. You do tend to congregate together. Mm. And there's Australians in Film, wonderful organization here that puts on screenings and things and events. So for me, it's not particularly glamorous. I mean, every now and then there might be something glamorous that happens, like if you get invited to an after party for the Golden Globes or the Emmys or something, which has only happened a couple of times, but that was fun. You know, they definitely know how to throw a party over here. There was the one, you know, we went to the Oscars one time just because I happened to be in an Australian short film that was nominated for Best Short. Yep. That was pretty cool. Yeah. But generally, no, it's pretty normal. It's probably not that different from being in Australia.
But also, too, that's a real shout out, Benny. Like when I go to America, the Australians in Film and to Damon's point, there really is a little group, isn't there? Like, it's not little anymore, it's growing. But I mean, the Australians really congregate together, like I think anyone would when they go to an area. So all the Aussies hang out. I mean, we got such support with Rabbit, and then Damon came to all the screenings, and then Australians in Film put on a screening and Q&As, and it's everyone really supports each other. And it's not that you're not hanging with Americans, but the Australians do seem to like they would as skiers if they were going to a skiing village, or in England they all, you know, end up at Hammersmith. It's kind of that way, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, and you do, you know, I have American friends but they're kind of my really close, dear American friends that I don't, I, 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 um, I don't have a massive group of American friends like I do with, you know, Aussie friends. There's just something about the shorthand, I think, of being from the same country that, you know, you have the same sense of humor, you talk about the same things.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, you know, without getting political, it's like when immigrants come to this country, we have a go at them for sort of like hanging out with all their friends and their people from the same country. And it's like, that's exactly what we do in other countries.
Right.
I mean, it's
so true.
You can't, why aren't you assimilating? Well, Australians hang out around West Hollywood. I mean, we go to London, we hang out in the same place. It's kind of, no, but you've got to all, you know, like every immigrant's got to go out and sort of like, you know, set up shop in Coober Pedy. I mean, what?
Coober Pedy.
I don't know, I just pulled out Coober
Pedy. When my wife first came to Australia, we were dating and we're living in Manly. She says to me, she goes, I've got this road trip planned. I'm going to hitch to Perth. And she showed me her map, right, of going from sort of through Coober Pedy, through Broken Hill, through Bourke.
Yeah.
It was just this beautiful drawing she'd sort of created. Yeah.
Little towns every 5 kilometres, a town or something.
And I think she'd sort of compared it to England, you know, just that little, I'm just going to just.
Right.
You know, and it was like, hang on, we need to have a chat about
There's
this.
A big pile of nothing out there.
You may never come back.
Yeah.
We may never see you again, which happens.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Oh, God.
You look younger than 10 years, like you really do. I'm sorry. Is it the Hollywood sun? I don't know. Is it your room? Is it natural light?
He's not going out in the sun.
The lighting.
Look at him.
I mean, I can show you.
He makes us look pasty and old. Yeah.
No, I just saw. I'm going to find a photo taken of me recently. I'm going to find one, damn it.
When you were playing a 70-year-old woman.
You just need to Google yourself. There's a lot of photos. Do you Google yourself? You ever done that?
Okay, that's a question.
I certainly would have done it. Hang on.
Yeah, no, do you Google? I mean, surely I Google you. Do you Google you?
I mean, not on a regular basis. I have in the past.
Over coffee with yourself in the morning, quick Google search.
Quick Google. How am I doing today?
What have I been up to lately?
Let's just Google newsfeed. I've got an alert here.
I did see on Wikipedia that it said that you won 3 Logies for the Sullivans.
It was obviously the Sullivans won 3 Logies. I know, you've won a bunch of Logies.
No, I haven't, but I've won one. I've only won one Logie.
You can't trust. We have this chat each week with people. Like, it's sort of like, you know, if Wikipedia is your sort of sense of, you know.
Look, okay, there's me in the last thing I did. I look my age there.
Oh, that's amazing.
It looks, is that a newsreader? Who are you there?
I'm
playing a cop.
Right, wow.
Like, that guy looks 50 or 45.
You look better in real life than you do in that shot, I will say.
Yeah, you do.
Well, there must be something about the lighting in this room.
It's good, man. It's good.
If you're over the filter or something.
If you're doing self-tests from that room, you are not going to lose a job.
I think you've got Zoom Premium, haven't you? You've got
Unless it's for a 50-year-old.
There you go, man. It's the power. Fire away, Benny.
So favorite director work with?
Yeah.
The favorite director that I have worked with,
yes.
You mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, there are ones that are just favorite because I can't believe I got to work with them. So Quentin Tarantino would fit into that, you know, basket. And then there are people I've worked with more than once that I love working with, like Abe Forsyth and Nash Edgerton and Jeffrey Walker. Dare I say Luke Shanahan's not bad.
There you go. I've got skills.
Dana Reed's wonderful. I mean, goodness, there are just too many. And Mira Folks, I loved working with. Yeah,
Mira's great. Maybe we should have asked him who he hates to work with, but he's not going
to
tell us.
Well, that one I'd have to just tell you off air, I think.
Yes, you should. You should. Yeah.
I actually don't know if I have one. No, no one's coming to mind. I've been very lucky, actually.
Yeah. I'm a massive fan of Clint Eastwood. So, can you tell us what that's like?
That was sort of what felt like the first truly out of the blue, unexpected thing that I could be working with someone like him who had been watching perform and direct movies from the time I was a kid. Mm. And suddenly to be directed by him, it was kind of surreal, to use that overused word. But he was lovely, incredibly quiet, didn't speak a lot, you know, just very, and his sets are incredibly quiet, very calm, but really made for a really pleasant shooting experience, because it even though I should have been nervous as hell walking onto that set, I really wasn't. Peaceful and calm.
I remember you telling me that. I think I was over in LA and you just said you were about to, or you just worked with him, and it was like you'd come from, you know, people like me that jump around and it's so sort of like, don't stop talking. And Clint was very reserved and almost like, okay, when you're ready. Like, was it not even calling action? Was it sort of just a
Usually wouldn't even wouldn't call action, just go in your own time or when you're ready, he would often say.
Just record.
Yeah.
No, I can imagine that. And he gives off that sort of reverence. It's almost like a gravitas. It's just like.
So how many times have you stood in front of a mirror and said, go ahead, make my day before you became an actor and just thought, that's what I want to do?
Are you looking at me?
We were always doing that in primary school, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. So it must be surreal, hey, seeing a guy like that.
We went to the first time he was in the same room as me, I just couldn't believe that that was Clint Eastwood. You just didn't seem like this it didn't compute. How am I in this room? You know, and then of course that wears off and you just sort of wow, he's a really nice guy.
Everyone's human, hey, at the end of the day. But do you still get starstruck when you're working with people?
I'm more starstruck when it's not an actor. I met Paul McCartney a couple of years ago. Was as starstruck as I've ever been. Nothing could come close to that. It could, you know, even if it were Meryl Streep or something, it couldn't come close. For me, I'd be more starstruck by musicians I really liked.
And I know how much of a fan of the Beatles you are. Yeah. So again, just give us a quick recap. How did that happen? How did you just wander?
That happened because Tim Minchin, who is a good mate, he knew I loved the Beatles, and the friend that I met Tim Minchin through, Kate Mulvaney, he knew that we were both massive Beatles fans, and Kate and I sort of bonded and formed a friendship over our love of the Beatles. He got 4 tickets to see Paul McCartney play at Madison Square Garden in New York because he'd done this special YouTube interview thing with Paul McCartney to advertise his Australian concerts, and the payment for that was 4 tickets and then after show passes. So he took his wife and Kate and me, and I will be forever grateful. And then we went backstage after the show, and Paul McCartney goes around to everyone in the room and says hi. And the thing that struck me most of all, other than just the oh my god, I can't believe I'm looking at a Beatle, was that the idea, which I'd never thought about leading up to it, was the fact that he was looking at me like there's a moment in history where Paul McCartney was only looking at me. And that is just so weird to me. Like his eyes were on me for 9 seconds in history. And that's just a weird thought that a Beatle was looking at me. It's just weird.
But he's gonna look,
it's not even like that I met him. It's like, you know,
I've heard that about him, that he gives time, like the time he gives.
He was lovely.
Like he's giving it, you know.
Absolutely. And in that moment, I mean, yeah, like you said, a Beatle was looking at you and the people he's looked at, and like he wouldn't remember. But for you, it's.
He will never remember. But for me,
he would remember. Yeah,
it's actually just is this a concept I never thought about, that actually it's one of the things that separates you from people who are idols to you, is that they're not looking at you. And when they do, it's really weird. when someone whether it's an actor you're working with or a scenario like running into Paul McCartney or John Howard, when someone does take the time to connect for just a second, it's so nice. It really illustrates that when someone doesn't do it, that you got to go. And of course, some people just are in a bad mood or they don't have time, but gee, it's nice when people do it, you know.
It's like that great story when I, I grew up watching The Young Ones, and then I was at a film festival with Rabbit and Ben Elton's film was there, and it was like, you know, Ben Elton, you know, co-wrote The Young Ones and many other things, and having a drink with him afterwards, and always just after a while, after I got over that thing of, you know, talking about and Rick Mayall and all this sort of stuff, you're sort of sitting there and you're just talking and he's just a normal guy. And then he said the most amazing thing is people are coming up to him and saying, you know, like meet him in the toilet or wherever they meet him and say, oh, I can't believe you're at the toilet. It's like, well, where am I supposed to be? You know, like where do I go? Is there a special toilet for Ben Elton?
A special toilet.
Is that like me having beers with Mark Taylor?
It's very much like you. Like you and cricketers.
Having a beer with Mark Taylor.
Having a beer with Mark Taylor.
Talking cricket. Cricketers love talking cricket. Dream film role. What was your dream role that you love the most looking back, and what's the dream role looking forward?
What's the dream role to get? What's next?
I probably we've talked about it, but I think probably Charles Manson was a dream role. Not that I was thinking about playing him, but having had that opportunity.
Born to play Manson, that's what your dad used to say.
It would be hard to not pick that one. Dream role yet to play. Gee. I always find it exciting if there's something to do that I feel like I haven't done before. I've sort of made a choice in the last maybe 3 years to not play, you know, horrible villains for a while, just because I did play so many of those in a row. Not that it probably matters to anyone but me, but I just felt like, you know, I just don't want to be that go-to villain guy, even though ironically I couldn't get auditions for those roles 20 years ago. I desperately wanted to play those roles, but I was never seen for them. But then I just ended up doing too many. So I don't know, just really something that I haven't done before. That's really interesting and challenging and well written.
That the American Office, that guy, John Krasinski.
Yeah.
The thing that I like about acting.
Versatile. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you can, whoever you dream you can be, you can pretty much be. And I think business is the same thing. I think if you dream it, you can do it. But I love that about turning on the TV and seeing this awkward guy from The Office now being this action hero.
It's kind of harder though in the acting, because no one's seeing you as a bit like, yeah, that is quite incredible. Like to your point of like, I mean, and Dave, you've crossed across, I mean, you know, characters as well. Like, because a lot of it does physically, you can't manufacture Brad Pitt out of yourself, you know, like you still got what you've got.
Cannot.
You know,
I've tried and failed at every attempt.
Brad Pitt type, please. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. There are some limits, Luke. There are some limits.
I wonder who I could play.
You could play a lot of characters.
Mark Taylor.
Tony, a lot of cricketers.
Best, sweetest, loveliest actor you've worked with.
Oh, goodness. See, again, there are too many. Look, I'm going to name one that just comes to mind because I worked with him recently, and that's Jimmy Simpson, who, for people who don't know who that is, Google him and I'm sure you'll know his face, because he's been in a zillion different things, from Westworld to It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and a bunch of other stuff. He and I did a show called Perpetual Grace Limited a couple of years ago, and I just adored him. But look, there are so many people who fit that bill.
What about, you know, someone that you've just, someone who's given you their time and you've gone, cool, I feel like I can walk out of this role a better actor because of that energy someone's given me. Is that consistent too? Are people good like that and generous with their time?
Yeah, you know, like I think of a thing like Justified, working with both Timothy Olyphant and Walton Goggins, two extraordinary actors who are both so nice to me.
Is Timothy as like hot as he, because my wife's got a, I mean, is Timothy just as hot in person? I know he's got like
a. He is an incredibly handsome man. There is no.
Very good looking rooster, that man.
Yeah, he is.
Right behind your wife, mate.
Yeah, there you go.
What about, okay, I want to be an actor. Where do I start?
Oh boy, that's the hardest.
That's actually a real question. That's, you know, he's
asking that.
Yeah,
that's right.
I see. Okay. Yeah. Well then, that is the hardest question. And you know, people do ask that. It's really hard. I wish I had a perfectly good answer for that. I mean, I think it would depend on how old you are for a start. You know, if you're young enough to audition for one of the acting schools that have a great reputation, I would say that's not a bad idea, solely because of, I mean, not solely, but to a large degree, because of how many people will see you when you graduate. You know, you it's a foot in the door to agents, casting directors, producers that you just can't get starting out on your own without that, you know. And you'll also make, I mean, I didn't go to an acting school, but I know plenty of people who did. They make great friendships, great connections.
It's contacts, same with film schools, directors. You don't know, it's contacts.
And do you train, Damon? Are you working on your art all the time, or is that something that comes from the work?
No, I'm not. I can't say I ever have done that I've heard of people doing that, and there are acting teachers who say you should be doing scene work every day. I mean, that just sounds like
hard
work to me. Now I said acting was fun.
I guess watching stuff too, isn't it? I mean, it's like, it's almost
The
Tarantino film school of like just watching stuff, watching people, watching actors.
That's interesting.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't
know. 100%. If you're watching great work, I'm sure that's, even though I didn't go to an acting school, I'm sure that's how I learned, is watching other actors who were good in taking taking things from them, whether that's happening consciously or not. It certainly rubs off on you to work with good people and watch good people.
It's what I do. Yeah, I mean, it's what I think everyone does. It's successful. Yeah, it's so you learn from other people.
You haven't taken your eyes off Ben this whole time.
There you go. I'm learning from him completely. I'm learning from business right now. Absolutely.
Very good interviewing skills.
You're late, man. You got to go back and catch up.
So what's next? What are we working on, and what's coming up?
Well, there's a couple of things coming out. There's a film at some point coming out called Nude Tuesday, which is a comedy, the comedy I made in New Zealand, which is a lot of fun. The entire film is nude. Despite the script being written in English, well, part of the film is nude, but also the script is written in English, but the entire performances are spoken in gibberish. It's completely made up and subtitled after the event by people who never read the English script.
Wow. So is that like just a made up language, like a NADSAT kind of thing?
Pretty much. Kind of like a made up sort of Scandinavian-ish sounding language. So that should be a lot of fun. It was incredibly good fun to make. Then I just did this thing about the Thai cave rescue that's going to be on Netflix at some point next year. There's a show called The Tourist, which comes out at the start of 2022 on Stan in Australia and BBC and HBO as well. And that's kind of a six-part thriller with, bits of everything. It's got some comedy in there, playing a detective in that.
Yep.
A couple of things coming up, but they're just kind of happening now. So nothing I can sort of mention without getting in trouble, but a couple of fun things that are both filming back in Australia.
Well, thanks, man. Thank you so much for coming on. It's been it's every time we chat, I say to Ben, it's like, I love catching up with you, and it's like, whether it be in LA or here. So thank you so much for coming in, waxing lyrical about your expertise.
I did get a...
My pleasure. No, great chatting with you guys. Thanks for having me.
I got a text from Luke at 5 a.m. this morning.
5 a.m. I was
so
like...
I'm so pumped to talk to Damon.
You make it, like, even through the journey that you've had, it's like, I don't know, you make acting... If I was listening to this and wanted to be an actor and I was 18, 19, or even 47, I would be like, I can do this on it.
It is impressive.
It's kind of just like, this is the way it is. And, and it's not saying it's been easy the whole way. It's been plenty of ups and downs, but it manages it. The journey has a resonance, every time we chat.
Oh, well, thanks. I appreciate that. And I think there's, I don't know what, my story sort of says about this business, but it's certainly, the way it worked for me was just sort of sticking around long enough. It kind of all seemed to fall into place. But I think also it's good to have a healthy attitude of, hey, this, I want to do this thing and I hope it works out, but it might not, a lot of people want to do it and a lot of it is luck.
It's a metaphor for life though, isn't it, Damon? It's like the thing I got from that conversation, that's when a business opportunity comes on my way, it's like, what does my life look like in 2 years as a result of this decision? Right. And I've learned that at 47. I didn't know that at 20. I love that feeling. Like, your story to me is just hope and possibility and opportunity for anyone who says, I'm just going to keep going. That's so rare, man. It's so good. So I just wanted to say that. I think it was a really cool.
Yeah. Oh, cheers.
All right. Well, thank you, man.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, Luke. Thanks, Ben.
See you, bud.
Thanks, man.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Ben.
Do you think we both went a bit too hard on the, geez, you look young?
Well, maybe, but he does. He's 51. He doesn't look, he's like, doesn't have any blemishes.
I think we went way too hard on that.
I don't know if he's like sponsored by a skincare brand or something, but he looks great.
We went way too deep with that.
It's okay. But it, like, if you Google Damon Herriman, he does look great.
Yeah. But look, great, incredibly gracious this time. I loved it that he's just in LA and it's his life now. And how normal that is and how abnormal that is for me. I know it's normal for you too, and you spend a lot of time in LA.
Oh, not as – I mean, I don't live there. Yeah. But Damon never changes. Like, it's not like, you hear these stories about people being tainted or sort of like – Damon has always been, and knowing a lot of his friendship, like, it's – he's never changed, It hasn't affected him.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I said this to him at the end, and he sort of brushed it away, nonchalantly because he's very gracious. But that point of – I love the fact that he doesn't see hardship in his journey. He just doesn't see it. Hey, I was when we were chatting to him, and I suppose this is something I thought I learned about Ben Baker in the previous episode too, was when we, and just I want to, this is both guys, and there's probably a common thread here. When I said to Ben, tell us about a hard time you've had. Tell us when it was tough.
Yeah.
And he actually couldn't answer it.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And he went into, well, you know, this was hard. But what I learned was that he chooses the hard road for everything.
Yeah.
So nothing's easy for Ben Baker.
No.
And all of a sudden when that question's posing me, he's like, what the fuck? I don't understand the question because it's all hard. I don't choose the easy shit. If it was easy, I'd be doing.
And you're dead right. And I think you're going to the point that Damon Herriman had that terrible year when he started with. And he's had a bunch of, you know, ordinary years early on. Now, I mean, he's a big famous movie star now, but they were tough and he kept going. And it's not like it's sort of like it's a scar on him. It kept it, you know.
It just keeps going, man. It's amazing. And that common thread between both of them, and you wonder why they're two of our most successful exported, you know, artists.
Absolutely. I'm going to get back to Adelaide one more time. What's in the water down there?
Lots of cricketers. They won the Sheffield Shield about 7 years ago.
There's something in South Australia. I mean,
we
knock it over here in the eastern states. Let's face it, we're in New South Wales here, and Victorians knock them too.
Darren Lehman, he was from South Australia.
Buff Lehman. But it's
– he was a good spinner.
I don't know why. I mean, they've got – there's a lot going on. Next week, we're going to have a rock star next week. I'm going to change it up. Change it up. Rock star next week.
Yeah, from one of Australia's most successful bands.
Big time drummer.
Of all time. With Take Out INXS, are they one of our biggest?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, if you took up that top three, if you were to say top three bands, I think you'd say INXS, Midnight Oil, and the drummer of the band that's coming up.
From Adelaide? Is he from Adelaide?
No, he's not from Adelaide.
Has he ever been there?
No.
They never played any gigs.
We give a clue. If we say where he's from, that'll really give it away.
Newcastle?
We could say Newcastle. Yeah, that could give it away. Anyway. Cool.
Thanks for listening this week, and thanks for joining us. And thank you, Luke, again, for just another great guest, mate.
You too, mate. Thanks, Benny. Bye.
See you next week.
Well, I feel better now. See ya.